for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program, Talk Radio for all of us. How's that for you? It's exposing the con in conservative, indeed, what we do every day. And speaking of which, the Ayn Rand was really one of the founders of what has come to be one of the major threads in the modern conservative movement, particularly within the Republican Party. It's gone through several metamorphoses, but Ayn Rand writing Atlas Shrugged, who is John Galder? Where is John? And this noble capitalist fighting against the terrible bureaucrats and the bureaucrats making things so terrible that the railroads just said, oh, that's it, screw it, we're not going to do business anymore, and everything falls apart. And a lot of people were galvanized by that book and others similar, essays, The Value of Selfishness and whatnot. And so objectivist thinking still stands alone, although some folks have morphed that into libertarian thinking, and some folks like Grover Norquist and others in the Republican Party have morphed that into what they call conservative or neoconservative thinking. So going back to the source of it all, ayn rand.org, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND. Richard Ralston is with us this morning. Hey, Richard.
Good morning. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Or this afternoon on the East Coast, for that matter. And welcome to the program. Richard, you're suggesting, by the way, our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, when the people fear the government, you have tyranny, and when the government fears the people, you have liberty, which is something I suspect you would agree with.
Well, yes, that's a little broad. As you well know, Ayn Rand was not a fan of conservatives or libertarians either, and I enjoy occasionally talking to an intelligent liberal.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. I hope I fall into that category. You're suggesting that the only way that we're going to have health care for all Americans in the United States is if we start having health savings accounts. Am I correct in my understanding of that?
Well, that is one good step in the right direction. It is not a cure-all. That will not get health care for everybody. But what it does, it gives a break to the people who want to take responsibility, do take responsibility, and want to make their own healthcare decisions. It means at least as they may struggle still to pay their healthcare bills, but at least they're paying them from pre-tax dollars. You know, if you get it free from the government or from your employer, it's all tax-free income. But the guy who's paying for it himself has to pay his taxes first and then do it. So it levels the playing field, and it puts it in the ballpark for people.
Why not simply make medical expenses free of taxation, like home mortgages are?
That would be the best reform, so that anybody, rich, poor, in the middle, on a tax-free basis, pay their own insurance premiums or their own out-of-pocket costs.
Okay, then we get the question. This raises two questions. The first one obviously is, what about those people who can't afford to pay for their own medical care? But we'll get to that in just a second. The other question that raises is it kind of the broader question of how is this? You know, are we using tax policy to legislate? You know, with health care, you know, and we've encouraged home ownership by mortgage. I mean, is tax policy really the appropriate way to do this?
I would say no, it's not the best way, but we're working with what we've got.
So what do you think is the best way, Richard Ralston?
I would get rid of the income tax and then get other sources of income, and you know, that would get that a bit out of the way. But the best way is to personal choice and what's called consumer-driven healthcare. I think there will be no control on cost unless you go to the extremes of rationing and things without people having some participation. Now, there's many things in our lives that are important, but a few of them are more important than our own life and health. I think people. It's erroneous to say people have no responsibility for any of their own health care costs. You might as well say they have no responsibility for any of their food costs or no responsibility for any of their housing costs. And, I would ask you, who does a better job at providing housing to the poor, Habitat for Humanity or the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
I think they have very different mandates.
Very different. But
and Habitat for Humanity is providing a very small amount of housing for a very small number of people.
True.
And Department of, you know, and HUD is doing it for a very large number of people, and I think both of them are doing a pretty decent job.
But if you look at, say, this, that's the 32nd survey of the 20th century, generally speaking, you can't look at the 20th century going by and say that across the board the government is a more efficient manager and producer than private enterprise. You know, neither fascism or communism, or in many cases very well-meaning democratic socialism, has been more efficient than the private sector.
If that's the case, then why would you want the government to provide the police department if private industry can do everything more efficiently?
Because that is the function of government, is the imposition of force to protect public safety. So private enterprise should never have the power to throw you into jail.
So why would you? I'll agree with you on that. Why would you want the government to operate the court system?
The same reason, because what the courts, by definition, the court system is the resolution of disputes between private parties.
No, okay. I've got the broad point. So you're suggesting that there is nothing that government can do more efficiently than private industry. And, in fact, the private health insurance companies point out that they can deliver health care more efficiently than, for example, Medicaid or Medicare. It costs between 2 and 3% for Medicare to deliver health care in the United States. And private health insurance companies claim they can do it for 1.5% to 2.5%. And they're right. But the actual expense to us ends up to be anywhere between 12 and 25% because they have to pay dividends to their shareholders. They have to pay multi-million-dollar salaries to their CEOs. They have marketing expenses. They got the private fleet of jets for. They got to pay the lobbyists. They got to pay all these other expenses. Efficiency isn't the only thing here, Richard.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Now, in terms of apples and apples, Medicare doesn't pay to collect its income. They graciously receive it. It's handed over by the 100,000 employees of the Internal Revenue Service, so they don't have to go out and collect premiums. Two, they don't negotiate rates. Whatever they pay is what they pay. And so that the providers either accept that rate or don't accept Medicare at all, and that results in...
Well, that's a form of negotiation. That's market negotiation.
But
enough providers say that they're not going to accept that rate, then Medicare is stuck not being able to provide health services to people. People yell and scream.
They do accept it, but the cost shifting occurs. In other words, if they don't break even on Medicare, someone else somewhere pays that.
No, if they don't break even on Medicare, they stop accepting Medicare payments. And then Medicare says, hey, we've got a problem, and they raise the payments.
Look back at the
last 30 years of Medicare. That's what's happened over and over again.
But the main thing Medicare does is they pass the administrative costs off to the provider. So, in other words, they say, here's the 130,000 pages of Medicare regulations. You figure it out. And if you get the coding wrong, you're subject to criminal prosecution.
But are not the health insurance companies saying the exact same thing, except instead of you're subject to criminal prosecution, you're subject we'll sue you, we'll take it.
That's the bargaining, the negotiated rate. But the it's difficult to compare costs because.
Well, let's bring this back to the average person because we've only got a couple minutes left here, and we're talking with Richard Ralston, ayanrand.org, the website.
Oh,
Richard,
by the way, I can give you some an HSA website as well if you like.
Go for it.
Okay, I'll give me two quickly. One word, HSAinsider.com. It's an excellent directory state by state of the insurance companies and banks that provide the accounts. And then I also do some part-time work for a nonprofit called Americans for Free Choice in Medicine. And their website is afcm.org.
Okay, so Richard Ralston, if you want us to go to health savings accounts, In this kind of pseudo-libertarian or conservative world that we have now, where I know that you're also opposed to minimum wage laws, we have a lot of people in the United States who can't even afford medical care right now. How are they going to afford a health insurance, health savings account?
The best way. I mean, many employers are picking this up now, and the employers match contributions. But.
I don't see Walmart doing that. You're saying let's just dump the burden on the employers?
No. Well, that's an employee benefit. I think employees can
What about people who are unemployed? What about people whose jobs went to China because of the liberal trade policies, the laissez-faire trade policies that you guys advocate?
How are they eating?
Well, some of them are eating government handouts, frankly, right now.
Well, where are they living? All I'm saying is that it's an inefficient system when people, all they do is collect all the services they're asking for, and they have no responsibility or cost. Is one of the things that's driving up costs. But they also, the price is they lose their own choices on the health care.
Got it. So we should all have our choices. Richard Ralston, IonRand.org. Thanks, Richard.
It's
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Robin Bush and his merry band ripped apart this happy land. It's Robin Hood with a switch. He steals from the poor and gives to the rich. The Bushies and the Foxies and the prehistoric Limbaugh.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or you can drop by smalldog.com. It is the pill that will help you escape the matrix, our program. Folks in the chat room making just a whole lot of really great points. One of the folks in there saying, you know, during the dot-com boom, we were part of the middle class, doing just great, and then the boom went bust, and Bonnie says, I'm still amazed that we made it through. And that is the story of so many people in America. If we lived in a world where everybody had an income where they could save their money, and save enough money to be able to pay for their health care, wouldn't it be a wonderful world? I mean, what happens if somebody gets cancer? At the average cost of cancer, $250,000 to treat cancer. Yeah, we're all and one in three Americans ultimately sometime in their life will get cancer. So health savings accounts, I'm sorry, we're not there yet, and we're not, and in terms of the average income of the average American, and we're certainly not going to get there if we consider these insane economic policies that have been foisted upon us by conservatives from George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Ronald Reagan, and in terms of trade policies, Bill Clinton and the DLC Democrats, the free traders. I'm sorry, it's ripping this country apart. Uh-oh. Time for a piggy alert.
Dr. Calculus. Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the starched white shed? You will find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts.
Yes, they always have clean shirts. Although yesterday, before the United States Senate, when the oil industry bigger piggies executives were brought in to be questioned by the senators, the Republicans were very gracious, very gracious. They didn't ask them to be sworn in. I mean, even Condoleezza Rice had to be sworn in when she testified before Congress. Remember that? The whole fight about that? Everybody's sworn in when they're testifying. Well, not the oil industry executives. And they removed the cameras from the chambers. So these guys Americans did not see them being brought in what might look like a perp walk, like the tobacco industry executives. So on top of that, this from Reuters, U.S. energy policies focus on the environment. New fuel specifications historically has hurt efforts to increase the nation's refinery capacity, says Chevron Corp's CEO. Yeah, right. Well, beyond that, the price gouging, you know, there's a lot of sparring between the senators and the oil company executives. And frankly, in my opinion, it was all posturing, or the vast majority of it was posturing. But there was one question that Ron Wyden of Oregon, the Democrat from Oregon, kept pounding on, and that was price gouging. And he didn't get any kind of reasonable answer from any of the oil industry executives. So he brings the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, Deborah Majores, forward and says, Madam Chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, what about price gouging? You know, shouldn't you guys be doing something? Isn't this what the FTC is all about? And her response essentially, no, we should just leave that to the states. Yeah, right. You in Ohio, you take on ExxonMobil. You in Oregon, you take on Chevron. Down in Oklahoma, you folks, I'm sure you can handle Marathon Oil Company price guy. Yeah, right. Just catch this. This is just incredible.
Whether there's a question of legality, we know for a fact that there was involvement.
Oh, excuse me, wrong clip. Here we go.
I just want the public to know you've got $2.6 billion of tax breaks. You've told me they aren't needed. I hope you'll support my effort to take them back and give that money to people who are hurting. One last question for you.
Now, that was, let's take back. This is Wyden talking to the oil executives.
Thank you, Mr. Raymond, if I might. You've been quoted as saying that speculation accounts for about $20 of the current per barrel price of oil.
Yeah, and this is where the oil industry executives got nothing to do
now
with that.
Now, your companies have been charging record prices and getting record profits, but also getting record tax breaks. Now, the president says they aren't needed. You've just told me they aren't needed. But Congress, just a couple of months ago, gave you several billion dollars in new tax breaks on top of the tax breaks you already
got. So step one, you're going
to
give back some of that money, guys?
Why shouldn't Congress take back the billions of dollars in brand new tax breaks that you've just told me aren't needed, and use that money to help people that are hurting in our country? Mr. Raymond, your response?
I've heard that comment made many times since the passage of that legislation, and I've asked my people many times if they could identify what so-called tax breaks are in that legislation.
Yeah, and he's ExxonMobil. We don't have any tax breaks. No. Then would you give them up? No, we wouldn't give them up. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with the FTC clip right after this. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
In a building of gold with riches untold live the families in which the country was founded, and the merchants of Spar with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded, and the noise outside was the ringing of revolution.
And that's what we're hearing now. Thank you, Phil Oakes. Welcome back to the program. 34 minutes past the hour, 35 minutes past the hour coming up on here. Tom Hartman with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. This is now Ron Wyden. I told you we'd get to it here. I wanted to set the stage. Now, after Ron Wyden has taken on a couple of the industry executives, and they basically go, he takes on the head of the Federal Trade Commission.
But the Government Accountability Office said that the FTC is a significant factor in why people are getting clobbered on the West Coast of the United States. And to this day, you haven't responded to it. So why don't we just stick to the issue before us today, and tell me why it is so difficult for the Federal Trade Commission to work out an arrangement so that the federal government can stand up for consumers the way 28 states do, the way these attorneys general do. Why can't we figure out a way to get that done?
Yeah, why can't the federal, the FTC, the Republican Bush appointee FTC, stand up to the oil industry?
Well, We can, and I'm trying to be constructive, Senator. I'm sitting here, and I'm telling you what we think and what these fine folks behind me who devote their lives to working on these markets think about this issue. If we pass price gouging legislation, sir, that only looks at cost as the only element that goes into price.
Now, nobody's suggesting we propose any legislation that only looks at cost. This is the great red herring, right? Because, of course, obviously, if you just go in and say, we're now going to set the price of gasoline, then, you know, you're going to screw up the marketplace. Nobody's suggesting that. But, you know, throughout the red herring and, of course...
During a time of shortage, and we enforce that on a wide scale, I submit to you that we will be back here because we will be experiencing shortages that are worse for our consumers. And that's what I'm trying to tell you. The proposals really only take
into account price. Are there any significant gaps right now in the agency's ability to protect consumers?
In this industry?
Yeah.
No.
Well, that's contrary to even what FTC people have told us. I've sat in hearings where the FTC has said that the agency can't do anything about a company that gouges unilaterally. I think that's a significant gap, don't you?
No, I don't think it's a significant gap. I don't. As we've said, we have states who can take care of this. These are local issues. States are in a better place to respond very quickly to local market conditions.
Yeah, okay. Oregon, you just take on ExxonMobil all by yourselves, Oregon. Good luck. And Michigan, yeah, you can deal with Chevron. We know you can do it. Amazing. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Steve in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I saw you here recently. It was a great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I watched a little bit of the oil hearings. It's just so too hard to watch the big piggies spinning like that. But what these guys said was really interesting in one respect. They, you know, each CEO said, well, we made $5 billion in profits, and we rolled it back into exploration and research, and we made $10 billion in profits, and we rolled it back in. And if I'm not mistaken, basically what they're saying is they didn't pay any tax on their gross profits.
It's a weird thing because if they rolled it back, it's not called profit. See, that's the thing. If you're running a business and you have money left over at the end of the month and you take that money and you buy equipment with it or you buy something else with it that's not going to depreciate, that you can't take some sort of tax break, and you know, but if you invest it in other things, that's not profit. That's reinvestment. Profit's what's left over at the end of the day. You know, I mean, the super theoretical or the super whatever, the tax definition of profit is the stuff that's left over at the end of the day that you distribute to your shareholders and you pay taxes on.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, the answer,
and then we spent it all.
Right. Yeah. And which clearly is not true. The answer, Steve, and thanks for raising a good point, Steve. The answer that really, you know, made me crazy was the guys saying, well, you just don't understand it. We're so big that our profits are so big because we're simply so big. And yeah, we're making the same percentage of profit as a guy who's running a hamburger stand. It's just that, you know, he's dealing in thousands of dollars and we're dealing in billions of dollars. So of course we're having profits in billions of dollars, which raises the question, how did we ever let, you know, a small number of corporations have the fluid oil on which our entire economy runs and on which our lives depend, have their hands around it in such a way that they were the only ones who were making a profit on it? Walter in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Walter. Walter, you're live and on the air.
Weakwood, you know, when you were on with Bernie, but I got cut off. Listen, the only way we could get these guys, these oil bastards, if you want to call them that, is to individually attack them. I mean, if every...
You're not suggesting violence. You're talking about boycotts.
No, not violence. No, sir. Take them to court. And, look...
Here's the problem. You try doing that, Walter, they have lawyers beyond anything that you could ever imagine.
Yeah, you know what? The lawyers, just like they presented themselves pretty lousy yesterday for a bunch of people that are supposed to be so damn sharp.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
And also, our Republicans presented themselves like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, Walter, here's the situation. Thank you for your call. You're well said. But the fact of the matter is that when you're dealing with a corporation that has billions of dollars and hundreds of lawyers, and not only that, they can deduct from their taxes the cost of those lawyers, none of us individually are going to be able to deal with them. As Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Teddy Roosevelt, pointed out, only the power of government can go up against big business. And so if you want to start breaking up some of these very large corporations and making them smaller companies, and people say, oh, well, wouldn't that be bad for business? Wouldn't that cause a recession? No, I'm sorry. When they broke up AT&T, it actually increased shareholder value. Jimmy Carter, the last president who enforced the Sherman Act, broke up AT&T. And actually, it was Jerry Ford under whose presidency that was initiated, by the way. And the Republican. And breaking up AT&T actually increased shareholder value, increased economic activity, spun off Lucent Technologies from Bell Labs. You know, all kinds of good stuff happened for shareholders. When you've got very, very large monolithic companies that essentially operate as monopolies, it's destructive to the free marketplace, not constructive. It's not useful. Dale in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dale, welcome to the program. Dale, you are live and on the air. Dale apparently doesn't know he's there, so we will go to Rich in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. I think us Americans need to remember the power we have with our dollar bill. And right now there's a new alternative, biodiesel. It reminds me of about 20...
Rich? Hey, Rich.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
We have the power right now to buy a different alternative fuel, biodiesel.
Mm-hmm.
If people would actually, it can be used in oil burns, it could be used in diesel cars, and they're beginning to become a supply of it. This reminds me of 25 years ago, the organic food movement.
Yeah.
You went into a health food store, the organic produce department consisted of two shriveled zucchinis and a wilted head of lettuce.
Right, and now it's everywhere. Now it's in Safeway. Absolutely. The last time I was in Germany, which was a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, they now have at every gas station a biodiesel pump. Yeah, it's not, you know, I mean, you can, basically any diesel engine can run on mostly biodiesel, a little bit of diesel, and you can modify them so they can run on pure biodiesel. And the guy who picked me up, he said, smell my car, you know, it smells like French fries. I says, you know, he says, yeah, it's recycled vegetable oil. So it's absolutely. Well said. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to comment on the short interview you had with the gentleman. Was it Ralston? Richard Ralston?
Yeah, Richard Ralston of Ayn Rand.
If you noticed when you questioned him about the fact that his premise seems to be that the private sector can always do things better, and you mentioned a couple of examples. I believe it was the police and the courts,
mm-hmm.
and you could say the military. He seemed to, as an article of faith, say, well, that's what they're supposed to do. He didn't answer whether they're actually being more efficient. And, you know, you can take as an extreme example, of course, the war against drugs. I mean, that's not working. The military...
Well, see, he would be opposed to that, by the way, I would say.
Pardon me?
The objectivists don't think that any drugs should be illegal.
No, because they're sort of libertarian. But the point is that's what they're doing, and they're not doing it very well.
I mean, the reason why I like putting these guys on the air, frankly, is because they are honest about their philosophy. It's
sure.
I mean, you get these Republicans on who really and truly believe that the poor should simply be left to their own devices, that there should be no social safety net, that, you know, the rich should get richer and screw the poor. That's what they believe, and that's how they behave. But when you get to talking to them, they talk, you know, the compassionate conservative line. They use the kind of language that George Bush used in the 2000 election. But these guys, at least they tell the truth. They say, I don't believe in democracy.
It's kind of strange, though, because it's actually a Calvinistic tenet, you know, which is that if you're rich, it's because God wants it that way, and if you're poor, it's because God wants you that way. The only problem is these objectivists are atheists.
Yeah, to many of them to a large extent. But good point, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We'll be coming back to your phone calls after this break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we run rings around the right wing every day. Try saying that three times fast. It's 45 and a half minutes past the hour. Number 1-866-440-THOM. Drop by our chat room, TomHartman.com. Click the live chat link and say hi to some of the finest minds in the entire internet.
Your You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our number. Jamie in Alberta, Canada on the line. Hey, Jamie, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you, sir, for taking my call.
Sure. Are you listening to us on the web or on Sirius Satellite Radio?
Sirius Satellite Radio, sir.
Oh, great.
I just want to let you know I'm a petroleum instrumentation engineer in Alberta.
Yes.
I'm working in some oil sands here, and I love your show.
Thank you.
One thing I'm kind of curious.
We've lost you, Jamie.
Yes.
Now you're back. You must be on a cell phone, too.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. Try it again. One thing I'm curious about.
One thing I haven't heard about is, you know, I understand that a lot of people get upset about all these billions of dollars that the oil companies are making. But how about maybe making a company, a government company, that, you know, they will take the resources from your country and our country, and instead of paying billions of dollars to a private company, that money will go towards the government, and maybe they won't be gouging because it will be controlled by the government. And
well, that's what Chavez did down in Venezuela, and it's one of the reasons why the Bush administration wants to take him out. He nationalized the oil. It's what Saddam did, by the way, just before 91, and that didn't make friends with anybody. It's what the Iranians did. They nationalized their oil industry. I think that you could actually make a fairly good case for the private oil companies that own private land that they're sucking oil out of, saying, okay, you guys, you own that land, you're taking the oil, even though the oil pool probably comes underneath my house as well. You know, we'll give you that. But what about the oil on public lands that's being pumped? Shouldn't that be owned by the public? But you know, I'm frankly not a big fan of the government getting into industry. But I do think, if your point is that the oil companies need competition in order to bring down prices and make things work better, I would agree with that. And I think the way to do that is to break up big oil companies into a whole bunch of small ones, like you have in Canada. You don't. My understanding is that you have a large number of small oil companies out there. Am I not correct?
Yes, and we used to have a government-owned company, Petro-Canada, that we actually they sold it. And,
right, it got privatized.
Yes, we privatized it. Now people are over here are kind of wondering, you know what, we should have kept it because the land and the oil, we could have been probably competing more aggressively. I could go to a Petro-Canada station and say, well, I don't want to fill up an Esso or Shell, because I know those profits at least are going to our government. It's going to taxes.
Interesting.
The
closest we can do that to that in the United States right now is buying from Citgo, where you know that the profits are going to the government of Venezuela, and they're using those profits for housing and food for poor people.
Yes.
In Venezuela, unfortunately. I mean, not unfortunately, but, you know, not in America, unfortunately.
Yeah, I like to listen to your show and everything, and I'm actually more of a conservative, but at the same time, like I say, I'm not really crazy about government and stuff like that, but, you know, oil, gas, that's actually a necessity. It's almost like food, and if people can't afford to heat their homes or can drive their vehicle because they can't go get groceries and stuff like that, it seems that it's really affecting both countries actually now.
This becomes then the reasonable realm of the government to say this is part of the commons, this is part of the stuff that's part of our survival. Jamie, thank you for your comments and for listening to us there on Sirius Satellite Radio. Judy in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Judy.
Hi, Tom. Your person that questions who's talking on the phone from New York didn't know where Bellevue, Washington was. I knew you were in Oregon. I'm going, Washington is? Sorry to say that. I'm a little irritated about the oil companies, the FTC, and he says, can you break it down to 5 words? He's from New York. Everyone thinks I'm from New York. Originally, I'm from San Diego, but I've lived in Redmond, Washington, now Bellevue for a long time. I'm going, oh, my God, they think I'm a New Yorker, but sometimes the New York people get on my nerves.
So I get
on my own nerves, essentially. Here's what I have to say.
Okay, Jim.
I'm very concerned regarding so many things. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, who's run by the Republicans to protect we the people. or whatever, supposedly what you were saying, the gas companies that the price gouging as food, water, oil, the heat this winter, people are going to die that are poor, that can't afford to pay heat bills in cold parts of the United States. Since Teddy Roosevelt, as you mentioned earlier, a few callers back regarding we the people must break up monopolies.
Yeah.
This is an essential commodity, gas, water, food. It's an essential for the people.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, Judy, and therefore it is essential, I think, that we start taking on this. Steve in Greenville, Tennessee. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Okay, I hate to throw a damper on bashing the oil companies.
But go for it.
Let's put this in perspective. I mean, I'm a truck driver, and this has hurt me recently, but America is the lowest price per gallon for fuel, any kind of fuel.
I agree. And I think, and it's not serving us well. We are consuming a third of the planet's energy, and we are only 5% of the planet's population, if that, maybe 4.5%. And so having the lowest priced fuel it's like the city with the lowest priced heroin has the most junkies. And
okay,
so it hasn't served us well. I'm not suggesting that the government should be jumping in and controlling or reducing the price of oil in order to encourage consumption. I think that we should be, you know, aggressively pushing for alternative sources. My concern with the oil companies is that they've got their hands around our throats, Steve.
Well, they do. I'm just putting it in perspective as far as the rest of the world and, I'm for other alternatives, and I'm for drilling in Anwar, and maybe not offshore, but Anwar.
Okay, great. You want to drill in Anwar. 10 years from now, you'll get 6 months' worth of oil. But ExxonMobil will make billions. Incredible. Steve, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 57 minutes past the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, AirAmericaRadio.com, et al. Welcome back to our program, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Robert Dreyfuss is with us. He's the author of Devil's Game and a freelance investigative journalist. His website, Robert Dreyfuss, DREYFUSS.com. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Robert. I'm really glad to have you here. You wrote an article, Tinker, Banker, Neocon, Spy, in which you said of Ahmed Chalabi, like Richard Nixon, Ahmed Chalabi continues to reinvent himself again and again. The latest reincarnation for the convicted embezzler is as a mediator between the United States and Iran. Somehow, and I think I'm fairly well informed, somehow it escaped me that the official mediator between the United States and Iran is Chalabi?
Well, you know, this is a man who is like a chameleon. He kind of adopts the coloration of whatever environment you put him in. He spent years in exile, as you know, before he rode the American tanks back to Baghdad.
Right. Well, you could call it exile. I would say it was in hiding. I mean, he'd been convicted of bank fraud in Jordan. He was facing, what, is it 23 or 27 years of a hard labor sentence?
Yes, he was convicted in, I think, 1990. He spent a lot of time in Iran in exile, and he got help from the Iranian Ayatollahs, who, of course, had fought a long war in the 1980s against Saddam Hussein. So they kind of took him, as well as some of the current leaders of Iraq, under their wing. And it shouldn't be too much of a surprise that Chalabi and his friends have a lot of well-oiled Iranian connections, despite the fact that the Iranians are part of the axis of evil, according to the president, and despite the fact that the president of Iran wants to, quote, wipe Israel off the map, unquote, Shalaby gets a good reception there and has very nice things to say about Iran.
Interesting. Interesting. So here's this guy who is good buddies with Iran. He's lived in Iran. And if you think back to a decade ago, 10 years ago, or a little more, when Iran was fighting, when Iran was fighting a war with Iraq, the number one mission of Iran, I mean, they lost, what, a million soldiers in that war?
Yes, exactly.
At least.
It was a horrible, horrible conflict.
Yeah, it was one of the worst, just in modern history, at least between two nations in a limited region. Millions of deaths, terrible weapons of mass destruction. So Iran's number one goal, I would say, was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Would that be an inaccurate statement?
No, that was definitely number one for them.
Okay, so Iran wants to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Iran has this good friend, Ahmad Chalabi. Chalabi comes to the United States, cozies up to Dick Cheney, starts feeding him information about how Saddam Hussein has these weapons of mass destruction and could attack the United States with unmanned aerial vehicles in 45 minutes and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And Cheney whips us up into war and you know, via Bush and Rumsfeld and Powell, and we go in and we take out Hussein. The only winner, it seems, in this whole scenario is Iran.
Yes, Iran. Well, Iran is one winner, but I don't think we should believe that Dick Cheney was fooled into going into Iraq. I mean, this was something that Cheney and his, quote, cabal, unquote, as people have now started to refer to it, were obsessed with for many, many years.
Oh, yeah. In 98, they wrote a letter to Bill Clinton, the you know, that's published
right. Shalaby,
on their website, saying,
Shalaby
please
was
do it.
More, I would say Shalaby was far more a tool of Cheney than the other way around, and probably still is. He has no real political base in Iraq.
It's more like a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, well, it's more like those little birds that sit on the back of rhinoceroses and peck away at the insects.
Yeah, I mean, in biology, that's called symbiosis.
Yeah, exactly. And Shalaby would be the bird in that case, and Cheney would be the big rhinoceros. And so the Cheney's rhinoceros herd is the one that wanted to stampede into the Gulf and occupy Iraq and show everybody that America was the big tough guy on the block and.
And use that to win elections and get some
oil. The oil belongs to us, and the Chinese better stay out, and everything else. So Shalaby was a useful idiot in that process.
So Robert Dreyfus, RobertDreyfus.com, your website, investigative journalist and author of The Devil's Game. Robert Dreyfus, why is it that Ahmad Chalaby is walking around loose in Washington, D.C., when they're, you know, the FBI is investigating him, leaking our secrets to Iran. There's evidence that he's complicit in the war crimes of this administration. Is it because of that, what I just said, that his complicity is basically also Cheney and Bush's complicity?
Well, lots of people are walking around free in Washington who are under indictment, including Tom DeLay and lots of other people. But yes, he, Shalaby, be a fit target for both congressional and FBI inquiries, and there is an FBI investigation into him, but he is also the deputy prime minister of a nation now.
And in charge of its oil.
Yes, he's in charge of its oil, he's in charge of every aspects of finance, he has a very important connection with security, so he's a powerful player. But as I mentioned, he has no political base, so he's dependent on his American connections, really.
Although when we went in and you know, it first was publicized that he had been leaking U.S. secrets to Iran, the United States went in and basically snatched his apartment, busted it up, searched it. It was widely publicized. They went in with film crews. Chalaby went to Iran to hide out. And that seemed to cause a lot of Iraqis to think, hey, this guy isn't in the pocket of the United States. Maybe he's an independent guy, particularly the Shiites. Maybe we should rally around him, didn't it?
Well, maybe. But, you know, to tell the truth, nobody really rallied around this guy.
Then how did he become the number two guy in the country?
Well, that's a good question. I think because the United States had such an important role in assembling, you know, piece by piece, this so-called government that exists in Baghdad now, that Shalabi was just a movable piece that was kind of shifted over into place. The reality is that before the war, Shalabi was really disdained, ridiculed by many people in the CIA and the State Department and other parts of the bureaucracy, who found him to be a charlatan. General Zinni, who is the CENTCOM commander, called him a silk-suited, Rolex-wearing exile, you know, posturer. So the fact that his home was raided may in fact have been something that occurred because parts of the government really don't like this guy.
Hmm.
On the other hand, he has his defenders among especially the neoconservatives, and they still defend him.
Both here and there.
Yes, Richard Perle and the American Enterprise Institute, where Shalabi spoke yesterday in Washington, and many of the other leaders of the what we used to call the Wolfowitz-Feith-Bolton part of the administration, they've all kind of moved on. Well, Bolton to the UN, but he's not in Washington anymore.
Now, here's an interesting twist. That part of the administration and the whole, the neocons tend to be very, very pro-Israel. Shalabi is an environment is in a political environment that is very, very anti-Israel. What is his position? How is he walking down that fine line?
Well, he and a number of other politicians in Iraq would like to pull their country in a much more pro-Israel direction. And on the face of it, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we all want the Arabs and the Israelis to settle their differences. But really, in Iraq now, he downplays that because, as you point out, and especially among the Shiite fanatics who dominate that country now, Israel is not exactly a popular topic. So I don't think we're going to hear much about an Israeli-Iraqi axis.
So very quickly, we have about a half a minute left. Robert Dreyfus, robertdreyfus.com. Do you see Shalabi as the next prime minister of Iraq?
No, I don't think so at all.
Seems to be working for it.
Yes, he's scrambling and wheeling and dealing, and I've heard he's spending millions of dollars in the December 15th election campaign. But I just don't think he has any support except inside the White House. And if the White House voted in Iraq, he would be prime minister.
Well, there have been allegations that every Iraqi election has been rigged or manipulated in one way or another by the White House. What do you think?
Well, I just heard that Catherine Harris was named our new deputy ambassador to Iraq. So maybe not true.
Assuming you're kidding.
I am kidding.
But somehow, you know, weird as it is, it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, elections aren't fixed only in Iraq. Let's put
it that
way.
There you go. Robert Dreyfus, robertdreyfus.com. His book, The Devil's Game, is also a great read. Check it out. Thank you for being with us, Robert.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I have got a story I've got to tell you about. It is absolutely going to blow your mind about. Bush has declared a war against the flu virus, and you're not going to believe who he has put in charge of it. It is absolutely mind-boggling. We're going to get to that and your phone calls in just a few minutes. First, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us with an update from the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, there's a few things going on. First of all, Mr. Shalabi had a press conference yesterday, or actually a speech, and answered some questions from the press. And I was there. My friend David Korn, and then even right-wing David Schuster, asked him about lying to the American people. And he essentially referred everybody back to the Silverman Robb report, and even to a specific page. Well, David Korn gets on his website today and puts and shows that essentially Shalabi was again lying through his teeth.
Surprise, surprise!
Well, I know. Aren't you just shocked? Meanwhile, today, as you know, the president is going to China and Japan next week. Today, the Byron Dorgan and Debbie Stabenow had a press conference on the Hill, which I also attended. And this has to do with the fact that the trade deficit today, as you know, reached essentially a record high.
Yeah, over $60 billion.
I mean, just alarming. $66.1 billion today. And it was very interesting. They kind of slipped this through the press, and nobody took a big notice of it, and we'll see what happens in tomorrow's papers. But they were talking about the leadership of President Bush not willing, of course, to press the Chinese on any of these trade issues. They pointed out that when there was a trade logo infringement of the Chinese Olympics, that the Chinese got on these people faster than the speed of light, but they don't care about American logos. And one of the things he talked about was leadership, Senator Dorgan, and he said he was talking about the leadership of both parties. And he basically also talked about when former President Clinton talked about the fact this is the first time we've had to borrow from foreign governments. He said it's $2 billion a day. It doesn't matter whether the Chinese and Japanese take this out in terms of cash or bonds that wind up. He said it is the selling of America off piece by piece.
And it really is. It really is. I mean, the last time we borrowed this big in terms of its relationship to our gross domestic product was before we were a nation, when we borrowed money from France to fight the Revolutionary War.
Exactly. He also said, Byron Dorgan said something else. There were not a lot of us pressed there today. And he said, if this were about some sexual escapade of some public official, the room would be totally filled. It is interesting that I guess Debbie Stabenow and Lindsey Graham, who you know is a Southern senator, are about to come up with a trade prosecutor bill, and they want somebody who is going to prosecute corporations on trade violations.
Interesting, interesting. But I'll bet that they still won't. Neither one of them will be willing to talk about tariffs instead of so-called free trade and these.
Dorgan and Debbie Stabenow are willing to talk about tariffs.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, I've got to get Debbie Stabenow on this program then and discuss that with her, because
I mean, what she said is that, you know, what happens is the European Union gets us for all kinds of tariff violations, and you know, we just let everything go through.
Yeah, yeah, and everybody else is protecting their economies, and surprise, their economies are doing fine. We don't protect our economy. We just make it, you know, super, super friendly for multinational corporations.
Well, you've got to get either Dorgan or Stabenow on. They're very good on this particular issue, I think.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I didn't question them in length. I couldn't, but I think they're pretty good. Also, there is some indication, given that the rumor is coming on the 2006 election, that the incumbent factor is looking as bad as it did, they say, as 2004, which is, I guess, good for the Democrats, but that also now the thought is, given the election results, et cetera, that the president may actually pull back some of his troops from Iraq in 2006. I wonder if it'll happen right before the election.
Yeah, gee, I wonder. You know, or the announcement, anyway. It's sort of like Nixon's secret plan to get out of Vietnam, right?
Exactly, exactly. Now, yeah. I was also at a black congressional caucus here. It was a sort of a press thing this morning. They're talking about their concerns about sludge in both Mississippi and New Orleans. And it looks like the EPA has given the Mississippi water a clean bill of health.
Oh, it's just fine. A little oil, a little benzene, a few chemicals, PVCs and whatnot, or PCBs and whatnot. But
I wonder if they're going to give that air quality with all that mold I've seen. By the way, I will be going down to Mississippi a week from Saturday.
Oh, great. And you'll be giving us a report on what you're seeing down there.
And although we're taking tomorrow off, Greg Gorman will be reporting next week, and it may be have to adjust the times a little bit, from the earthquake area in Pakistan, Kashmir.
Greg is going to Pakistan?
He's leaving on Sunday.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'll look forward to hearing from him. It's always great to be in touch with Greg, and that's some serious reporting. That's a part of the world I've been close to, and it's not easy to get into in the first place. And,
Well, he will definitely be reporting from there next week.
Yeah, well, I wish him well, and you too. So.
And actually, part of the reason, even though it's Veterans Day, we're taking him out of office because Greg and I have got to run around town and buy the right cameras and do all the right things so he can go.
Get ready for the trip, yeah. Okay. Well, good luck, and tell Greg to take a lot of acidophilus with him and some C-Pro. So.
Yeah, don't worry. That's part of our shopping list.
All righty. Good talking
to you,
Ellen. Thanks a lot. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, our daily report from Washington, D.C. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Have you ever got a note from your bank saying,
"Greetings, your account just shrank by 25 or 30 bucks. Sorry, friend, you're out of luck. You bounced a check. That's what it was. It happens to the best of us. Please cover it quick."
And when you do, you find you got another one or two. Because what they done, never seen it fail, they notified you by the U.S. mail. Cost them almost 40 cents, but more than worth that little expense. Because by the time you receive that letter, their situation got even better. Your first overdraft cost a couple more. Now you owe them a pile of money for sure.
They hope you never wonder in your little head why they don't send you an email instead. A quicker way and cheaper, too, for them as well as the customer, you.
Or an automated call to your phone or pager would be an improvement vastly major, but they'd lose all those overdraft fees they charge you. A profit center very large. See, that's what they call it. The banks charge you two or three times and then say,
"Thanks for making us rich at your expense."
There
Thank
you go.
God
Welcome back. Yes, we are all slaves to the robot corporations. 35 minutes past the hour. That's from Jim Turr from BlueCanyonProductions.com, by the way. One of his many great satires, BlueCanyonSatire, I believe, .com, also a website. Remarkable stuff.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, indeed, my friends. What's going on inside the Bush administration that they're not really telling you about? You know, George Bush has come out now, and he has declared war on the flu. An all-out war on the flu. Yes, indeed. Well, if you, as somebody in the chat room pointed out earlier, if you can have a war on a noun, on terrorism, is that a noun or is it an adjective? Yeah, it's a. In any case, if you can have a war on a part of speech, you can certainly have a war on an actual microorganism. So Bush has declared war on the flu. And reassured us all, everything's going to be fine. He's put Stuart Simonson in charge of it. As Jeremy Scahill points out in The Nation, the next upcoming issue of The Nation, meet Stuart Simonson. He's the official charged by Bush with the protection of the civilian population from acts of bioterrorism and other public health emergencies. Wow. This is the guy who's going to protect us from the germs that are going to kill us. He must be a doctor. No. He must be a public health expert? No. He must be a civil defense expert? No. He knows how to run a police force? No. What did he do? Well, he's a corporate lawyer. Just like Michael Brown. You know? A corporate lawyer, only he worked for Amtrak instead of for the Horse Breeders Association. So you can be reassured he knows how to be a lawyer for a railroad. Yeah. This is why Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former number two guy under Colin Powell, said, and I quote, now this is an administration official, a former administration official, Bush administration official, Colin Powell's right-hand man, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, said, quote, "If something comes along that is truly serious, like a major pandemic, you are going to see the ineptitude of this government in a way that will really take you back to the Declaration of Independence." Simonson, Stuart Simonson, the guy, our new Michael Brown, not the head of FEMA, but the head of the Public Health Service, now Stuart Simonson says, "We're learning as we go." Quote, Ed Garvey, prominent Wisconsin attorney, former deputy at Wisconsin, from which Mr. Simonson, Henry Waxman, Congressman Henry Waxman, says Mr. Simonson is a lawyer, not a medical expert. He's a little concerned that he is an inexperienced individual with political connections. Yeah, recently before the House Government Reform Committee, Simonson, quote, claimed he had sufficient funds to purchase influenza vaccine. His office submitted a funding request to Congress seeking an additional $150 million for flu medicine and antiviral medication. This from Henry Waxman. Incredible. Incredible. So, just a heads up. We'll deal with that in a little more detail as time goes on. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. 866-440-8466. And Kate in Arcata, California, on the line. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment on something that Richard Ralston said from the Ayn Rand Institute about healthcare.
In the first hour, our super ultra uber conservative objectivist guest who was saying that everything would be fine in America if everybody simply had a health savings account.
Exactly.
Essentially, not to put words in his mouth. It's an unfair thing to do, but that was the gist of it.
General gist. I wanted to make two points. One was that as soon as we have a living wage using the criteria outlined by Teddy Roosevelt that you often play, as soon as we have a living wage instead of a minimum wage, maybe we can think about that.
Well, one of Roosevelt's criteria for the living wage was enough to provide for family members during times of sickness.
Exactly.
And the reality was that in 1900 to 1908, when Teddy Roosevelt was president, doctors were relatively inexpensive and hospital visits were not that. People didn't get wiped out by medical expenses, by and large. But medicine has changed. It's been privatized. It's become more high-tech. It's become much more expensive.
Well, and also there's an attitude that if people can't afford health care, he used this language himself, that he implied that it was their own fault if they haven't bought health care for themselves.
They haven't made the choice.
Exactly. And,
yes.
You know, so many people, myself included, haven't had the option to buy health insurance because my wages didn't add up to enough to be able to afford the policy.
Yeah.
So anyway, the second point I wanted to make was that so much depends on language. And I think that if we turned our thinking around a little bit, we might be able to see that if we collectively have a national health savings plan that we all can tap into. It's just another way.
That's called insurance.
Exactly. And that's just it's a publicly funded by ourselves, we the people, funded savings health plan that we all choose to use. We all choose to contribute to.
This is what you're describing, Kate, is also what Social Security is.
Again,
the cons
point.
Like to say Social Security is a retirement program. It's not. It's an insurance program against poverty.
Exactly. And we all choose to do that for ourselves and for one another.
Yeah. Well
and,
said.
It was great. I had to hold on a really long time, which means you're getting lots of calls and you're getting more and more successful with your program.
Thank you, Kate.
Excellent.
Thanks for your kind words, and thanks for calling, and thanks for holding for so long. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Honored to talk to you again.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I just want to remind your listeners about Rumsfeld's financial gain in the Tamiflu vaccinations.
And Rumsfeld was an executive with the company that owns the patent to Tamiflu. Is that I have the whole history around here someplace, but it's been a week or two since we talked about it.
And it's nauseating and it's disturbing how they're once again trying to distract everyone's attention from these upcoming indictments.
The story that I thought was the most interesting was, I believe this is as I recall, was that Rumsfeld wasn't he the CEO of Searle Pharmaceuticals at one point? He was the CEO of one of the pharmaceutical companies, and this company brought forward a product which seemed to be relatively toxic. When it got exposed to heat, it broke down into formaldehyde, and it's broken down in the liver into formaldehyde anyway.
Wow.
It does have some toxicity problems, but it's sweet. And so Rumsfeld, as the CEO of that company, pulled political strings in Washington, D.C., and got a product which is now known as aspartame, approved for use. It's in pretty widespread use. And, you know, it may be perfectly safe. It may be that what the government says is right is that it's safe. But there's a lot of people scratching their heads that, you know, about Rumsfeld's role in that as well. David, thanks for calling and raising the issue. I appreciate it. David in DeQuinn. Is it DeQuinn, Illinois?
It's DeQuinn, Tom.
DeQuinn. Hey, yeah. David. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
About the electoral process, Tom,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, about paper ballots.
Yes, sir.
This
being the day after the election, it's a good time to talk about it.
Well, you know what? This is always, it's always before the next election.
You're right.
Someone said politics is a continuous campaign punctuated by elections. So we're talking about this before the next election. And actually, the changes that need to be made, we're going to have probably 2 to 4 years ramp up anyway in order to implement them. So even with paper ballots, fraud occurred. Fraud occurred before computers came into existence.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind, David, that 7,000 years ago in Sumeria, when people were voting with pottery shards, that there was voter fraud.
So here's the problem. One, all those failed voting systems share one thing in common. The person who casts the vote, Tom, cannot verify their vote after they leave the polls. This is very critical. You've got to be able to verify your vote after you leave the polls.
Now, yeah, we talked about this earlier in the week or last week, David, and my concern with putting that onto the Internet so that you can verify your vote is that anything on the Internet is no longer safe.
Well, you can also go down to the local courthouse and verify it there. So you've got two levels. Now, look.
But you're not able to verify that your vote actually got put into that aggregated pool that was counted.
Sure you can.
How?
If the public vote is the most important public record we have of all the public records we've got in a democracy.
Except that we have secret voting in the United States. We actually didn't start out that way, but we do now. David, I'm sorry, we're out of time.
I don't get to make my point. But,
okay. Well, let me put you on hold, and you can make your point right after this break. You know, never let it be said. But we got to get to it quickly. It's 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. David in Illinois, you were making your point.
Yes, sir. Thanks for allowing me to finish it. Tom, if you and I and your screen caller go to the polls, the same poll, the same precinct or ward, and we cast our votes, three of us have voted. When we leave the polls, if you and I say, hey, let's verify our votes just to make sure that they were added correctly to the public record and counted correctly, summed correctly, and then we have a unique random identifier on our receipt. We go out, we look at it on the Internet. It's just the way we voted. Maybe mine's just the way I voted. Maybe yours has a little discrepancy in it. You go down to the courthouse, you verify it there. Yours has a discrepancy there. Your vote was not added to the public record and summed correctly. Now, that is the only person who can validate the vote is the person who cast it. Without that system, our vote will never, our voting election system will never have validity. We will never have a true democracy because it will be fraught with fraud and the capability of fraud. So that's the beginning. There's other things that have to be done, obviously lengthening the amount of time allowed for people to cast votes and that sort of thing. One day isn't sufficient. It almost needs to be 2 days. But
that's the key to it. David, thank you. You made your point. You made it eloquently and you know, well said. I don't disagree. I just, you know, we've gotten this far without having Internet verified votes or even being able to go back down to the courthouse and say, let me see my vote. Because traditionally what we did is we voted on a piece of paper and that piece of paper, you know, was kept around as a record. Now, I suppose you could make the argument that sometimes ballot boxes got stuffed. And in fact, sometimes they did. By the way, I was told, I think I gave out our old toll-free number, our current number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. But, you know, I wouldn't disagree. You know, I think not a bad suggestion. Not a bad suggestion. China, to whom we are terribly in debt. We are borrowing $2 billion a day from the rest of the world in order to finance our government. Get that. We're borrowing $2 billion a day from the rest of the world so that Bush can give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires and continue spending money however he damn well pleases, basically. He hasn't vetoed a single piece of legislation since he became president. This is pretty unprecedented. And an awful lot of that money we're borrowing from China. Perhaps as much as a third of it. We're also borrowing money from China in order to be able to buy things from China. China, which is sitting on this huge pile of U.S. dollars. And by the way, when we borrow money from China, we don't just say, hey, give us some money. We also agree to pay them interest on that money. And interest rates are going up, so their profit on our borrowing is going up, and the cost to you and me of that borrowing is going up. The interest on the national debt is growing every single day. Greenspan cranks up the prime by a quarter point, and everybody goes, oh, well, you know, isn't that fine? Control inflation. And what people don't realize is that the national debt, $7, $8 trillion, we're paying interest on that. The interest rate just went up. You know, when treasuries follow the prime rate, as they generally tend to do. Eventually, you could argue they always do. And so Bush's borrow and spend policies that he's been pursuing since he came into office, just like Reagan's borrow and spend policies, are now costing us and our children and our grandchildren and may well be our great-grandchildren even more. Anyhow, China, which is sitting on this great big huge pile of money, is now has $1 billion. That's a mind-boggling amount of money. That's a mind-boggling amount of money. $180 billion. That's about what we've spent so far. It's a little more, it's a little less actually than we've spent so far in the war in Iraq. It's enough to basically, it's a mind-boggling amount of money. They're going to spend that to cut their use of oil by 15%, so that 15% of the energy that they're using will come from the sun and the wind and wave power. Renewable energy. Zhang Guombo, the Vice Minister of National Development and Reform Commission, said renewable energy, including solar, wind power, and hydropower, will contribute to better energy security in China. They're going to work on biomass. They hope to replace tens of millions in tons of coal each year. China. I wrote about this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, back 8-9 years ago when I wrote the first draft of it, that the Chinese were saying, when I was in China in 1986, the Chinese were saying the next century and the next millennia, the next 1,000 years, the next century is going to be the Chinese century. The last century was the American century. The century before that was the European century. The next century is going to be the Chinese century. You watch. And they are making the plans. They are preparing in a rational and straightforward fashion in ways that are beyond the capacity of even the thinking, apparently, of this administration. And you know, far be it from me to say admiring things about a brutal dictatorship, a communist country, communist China. But, hey, you know, maybe we should be paying some attention to this. Right now, if we want to build solar devices in the United States that are controlled by microchips, as almost all of them are, most of your more sophisticated, you know, wind power, solar power, they have little mini computers built into them that, you know, keep track of where the we buy our chips from China to make them work. What's wrong with this picture, my friends? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone. I was going to say high up, I suppose actually kind of settling down. We're on the banks of the Willamette River here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, but broadcasting from coast to coast. I've actually lived coast to coast. It's time, I think, you know, for us to acknowledge when somebody has done something right. And, you know, my favorite, you know, caught you doing something right message. So I've got two of them today. Two. We're going to catch two people doing something right. You know, it's always more effective to catch people doing things right than to catch them doing things wrong. You want to motivate somebody, you tell them, hey, good job. It always works better than saying, hey, don't do that. And, in fact, a lot of people think that the key to management and parenting is to catch people doing things wrong over time. You know, it's like whipping a horse. It'll go faster for a while, but eventually it'll fall over dead. If you want good long-term results, catch people doing things right. So I like to do that on this program, and I've got two for you today. The first is the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes. Believe it or not, this actually from a right-wing website, Consortium News, CNSNews.com, they're actually worried about it. They're concerned about it. In fact, I'll just read it straight. You can get this from Craig Bannister, the communications director for CNSNews.com. After being dragged kicking and screaming into an Al Gore lecture with Robert Kennedy Jr. and cornered and charmed by producer Larry David's wife, Fox News Channel CEO Roger Ailes has emerged convinced of the threat of global warming. You get this? Roger Ailes convinced of the threat of global warming. And so convinced that he's going to produce an admittedly one-sided documentary on the topic. The heavily promoted The Heat Is On, The Case of Global Warming, which airs Sunday night, November 13th, presumably on Fox News, will make an unabashed argument that mankind, or maybe it's on Fox Network, I'm not sure which. Isn't it ironic, by the way, that Fox Network airs all this racy stuff that then Fox News picks on? Maybe that's all they do it with us. Anyhow, The Heat Is On, The Case of Global Warming, which airs Sunday night, November 13th, will make an unabashed argument that mankind is committing global suicide by causing global warming without providing the balance of opposing scientific facts and viewpoints. Now, that part, that without providing the balance, that part was actually underlined in the email that I got from this right-wing director of this right-wing news website. I mean, they're flipped out about this. How could he do this? How could Roger Ailes run this documentary, The Heat Is On, The Case of Global Warming, without providing the balance of opposing scientific facts and viewpoints? Well, it could be that there are no scientific facts opposing it, and the opposing viewpoints are so marginal. Well, anyhow, you know all that. And back to the story. Ailes' conversion is so complete, in fact, writes Craig Bannister, communications director for CNSNews.com, that Robert Kennedy Jr. has been publicly bragging about his part in helping Ailes see the light and embrace the environmentalist conspiracy theory. Yes, my friends, it's an environmentalist conspiracy theory. No, those glaciers really aren't melting. No, Mount Kilimanjaro isn't really shrinking, the snowcap. No, those glaciers, the Larsen A and B shells, didn't really vanish from Antarctica. Those giant pools of melt where there used to be permafrost in the northern slopes of Canada and northern Alaska aren't really forming. It's an environmental conspiracy theory. Anyhow, a spokesman for a leading think tank, of course that would have to be one of the ones funded by the oil companies, Craig Bannister writes, a spokesman for a leading think tank accuses Fox Network of abandoning its fair and balanced motto and declares the upcoming program a disgraceful excuse for journalism. So, congratulations, Roger Ailes, for running a disgraceful excuse for journalism. That is to say, a program that actually talks about, you know, stronger hurricanes, more the damage of global warming. Amazing. Isn't that great? And my second caught you doing something right. I told you this was a twofer. And keep an eye out for this. This actually happened a week or so ago. It hit the headlines in England big time. Actually, It was a week or so ago. Hit the headlines in England big time last week, as I recall. Today it was in the breaking news, the news.com.au, the Australian press. Let's see if this shows up in the American press, or to what extent it shows up. I'll just read this straight to you from the Australian news site, news.com.au. And this is not a liberal. It's actually from the newspaper, The Australian, which is a nationwide newspaper. Sort of like USA Today for Australia. Here's the story. The Vatican. Yes, that Vatican. The Vatican has issued a stout defense of Charles Darwin, voicing strong criticism of Christian fundamentalists who reject his theory of evolution and interpret the biblical account of creation literally. Say what? Yes, the Vatican has issued a stout defense of Charles Darwin, voicing strong criticism of Christian fundamentalists who reject his theory of evolution and interpret the Bible account of biblical account of creation literally. It's incredible. Well, of course, the Catholic Church is running schools all over the world. They want to make sure that the kids who graduate from their schools can actually go to college and study science. Cardinal Paul Poupard, head of the Pontifical Council for Culture, this is at the Vatican, in Vatican City, the only nation in the world that has only men as its citizens, and ironically has a seat on the United Nations Council on Birth Control. In any case, Cardinal Paul Poupard, head of the Pontifical Council for Culture, said the Genesis description of how God created the universe and Darwin's theory of evolution are, quote, perfectly compatible, end quote, if the Bible is read correctly. His statement is a clear attack on creationist campaigners in the United States who see evolution and the Genesis account as mutually exclusive, said the good Cardinal Paul Poupard at a Vatican press conference, quote, the fundamentalists want to give a scientific meaning to words that had no scientific aim. This is the Vatican. He said the real message in Genesis was, quote, the universe didn't make itself and had a creator, end quote. But it's got nothing to do, he's saying, with intelligent design, and evolution may well be how the creator brought us about. Well, back to the article by Martin Penner in The Australian. The idea was part of theology. This idea was part of theology, Cardinal Poupard emphasized. While the precise details of how creation and the development of the species came about belong to a different realm, science. Cardinal Poupard said that it was important for Catholic believers to know how science saw things so as to, quote, understand things better, end quote. His statements are interpreted in Italy. Of course, that's where he gave them. Well, Italy surrounds the Vatican. His statements were interpreted in Italy as a rejection of the intelligent design view, which says the universe is so complex that some higher being must have designed every detail. End of article from The Australian. So, you know, it's amazing to me the stories that just don't get reported and the stories that do and how they get played out. For example, and particularly with regard to religion in the United States, religion and politics, the Catholic Church, and I'm not a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, but the Catholic Church came out and argued strongly, forcibly, against the United States attacking Iraq. The Pope personally asked George W. Bush, or tried to, ask George W. Bush not to invade Iraq. The Pope personally tried to intervene in the execution of a mentally retarded teenager in Texas when George W. Bush was governor. The Catholic Church officially is opposed to the death penalty and officially opposed to the war in Iraq. That does not get reported in the United States. But when the guy who's the current pope, as a cardinal, sends out a letter to the bishops in the United States saying, don't give John Kerry communion, it makes huge headlines. What's going on? 15 minutes past the hour.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tell them, Johnny.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
There you go. Welcome back. 21 minutes more or less past the hour. Viagra for your brain here, the Tom Hartman radio program. Pleased to have you back with us. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 8466. And TomHartman.com, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room. The board that sets U.S. accounting standards will consider an overhaul of pension rules. This from Bloomberg News. And may force companies to include plan deficits and surpluses on their balance sheets by the end of next year. Wait a minute. If a company has a pension, which is a promise to its employees to pay them in the future, they don't have to show it on their balance sheet right now? So they can show up, I'm not a CPA. I didn't know. The Financial Accounting Standards Board unanimously approved a staff proposal to recommend a 20-year rule that permits companies to delay recognition of pension plan investment gains and losses and changes in obligations to retirees. Companies use such tactics to smooth the effects of short-term market volatility. Well, it makes a certain amount of sense, I suppose. But here's where it gets really, eye-popping. The review follows a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission report in June that found an estimated $535 billion in pension deficits were placed off balance sheets by publicly traded companies. That's a half a trillion dollars that publicly traded companies are saying, we're not even going to put this on our balance sheet. Tim Vandenberg, senior policy analyst at Washington Analyst, says, this is enormous. Most people don't realize it, but the bulk of S&P 500 companies all have defined benefit pension plans. It's not just the old line automakers. This is really quite extraordinary. More than 1,100 U.S. companies reported having pension plan deficits at the end of 2004, according to the agency, covering 15 million workers, an aggregate shortfall of $353 billion, up 27% from the year before. A lot of Americans who thought that they were going to have pensions in their retirement are going to have a horrible surprise. This is very bad news. Very bad news. And where's the Bush administration on this? Oh, we just let the marketplace decide everything. It's really the best. Just let the marketplace, after all, the marketplace does a good job of supplying voting machines, doesn't it? Hey, Jesse, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM. What's up, Jesse?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to get your opinion on something. Are you surprised that a class action suit hasn't been filed against the makers of these voting machines, Diebold, ES&S, for election fraud?
No, I'm not, because a class action, I believe, I'm not an attorney, and Paul Leto or one of the activist attorneys who are involved in these things would be the person to ask, but I believe that a class action lawsuit on the part of consumers can only be filed when the consumers are the actual purchasers of the product. In other words, if
we are.
We're not. Our government is. I mean, at law. I understand and agree with you that technically we're the ones who are buying the voting machines, but we're buying them through government agencies. And so it would have to be the government agencies that are suing them. And actually, there have been some of those. And uh-huh. we had Kevin Sheehy, I believe, or Sheely, on this program a few weeks ago, the former Attorney General of the State of California, or the former Secretary of State of the State of California, Kevin Shelley. And, he was talking about how, they went after Diebold and other companies. And it would be the sort of thing that you'd have to have your individual states doing.
Okay. So, and do you think that would be effective?
I think what would be effective, Jesse, the goal that you're trying to reach, I assume, is that we don't want to have our votes being handled by private for-profit corporations. Is that right?
Well, my goal is that the federal they would require paper audit trails, that they would require local verification certification, things
right.
like that. That's just the whole spectrum of things. Fraud. And, public disgrace and
yeah, there you
huge
go. I'm right there with you. In fact, I take it a step farther. I say that, just like we say Yellowstone is part of the commons, and we would all be outraged if the government sold Yellowstone off to General Electric and said, well,
exactly,
GE can administer it more efficiently than we can, or if they said, you know, we've got a nice army, but from now on Halliburton's going to run the army. You know, we don't privatize the commons. I say that the most vital part of our commons, the most vital part of that which we all collectively own through our government, is the vote itself, the mechanism of voting. And therefore, privatization of the vote, in my mind, is a felony against democracy. I don't think that private corporations should be involved in the vote at all, in counting the vote. I mean, I have no problem with the government buying a voting machine from a private company. We've been doing that for 40 years with lever machines, for example. But
yep,
the government should be programming it, the government should be handling the software, and it should be done in a completely open source and transparent way.
Exactly, because they're buying defective products, they're buying products with computer defects, and it's going against our civil rights and civil liberties.
That's right, and with backdoors. So if that's your goal, Jesse, rather than trying to litigate our way out of this thing, I think what we need to do is we need to wake enough people up, because what you find is that government generally leads, it doesn't follow. I mean, follows, it doesn't lead.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's whether it's legislative bodies, you know, legislatures, or whether it's the courts, even including the Supreme Court. We didn't get Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 because the Supreme Court woke up one day. It was because of, you know, decades of work on civil rights. We didn't get Roe v. Wade in 73 because the Supreme Court woke up one day and said, hey, maybe women should have rights just like men. It was because of decades, centuries of work on behalf of women's rights activists. And so I think that what we need to do is we need to wake up as many Americans as we can to the idea, the meme, the thought virus, that the vote is part of the commons. The vote is the property of we the people, and that privatizing the vote is criminal.
It is. And do you think that they are racketeering under, what do you know? I mean, I don't know much about the RICO Act, but do you
yeah,
think they're...
I don't either. I'm sorry, Jesse. I just,
yeah,
I just don't.
Yeah, I don't
know
anything.
But the bottom line in my mind is just very simple and straightforward. We just need to say, no, we don't want private corporations owning our vote any more than
yeah.
we want private corporations owning Yellowstone National Park, and it's
it has
just
to be
wrong.
Done.
Yeah,
it
I agree. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. And the more people you can spread that, hey, did you know that our vote has been sold to the highest bidder, or in this case, the lowest bidder? Something wrong with that. There's just something wrong with that. Wake some folks up. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Thought I heard a rumbling calling to my name. 200 million guns are loaded, same cry they came. Better run through the jungle.
Yes, you better run through the jungle, my friend. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. 34 and a half. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi in just a second, we're going to have a Taking My Country Back alert. I got to tell you about this. It's so cool. But first, Annie in Olympia, Washington, on the line. Hey, Annie, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to talk about health care, and I want to talk about a piece of business that I don't think often gets addressed. And it has to do with the way the current system actually functions, which is that the bulk of health insurance for people comes through an employment-funded program, through their work.
Right.
And what that does is that what that really means is that that huge bulge of money that flows from the working Americans flows from people who are healthy and working, and that's the key, and for their families. And essentially, then, what I'm saying is that it's healthy people that are flowing the profits, flowing the money toward health care through their insurance and their employment-funded health insurance.
Yeah, and it makes us incredibly uncompetitive. This is why you had a Japanese automaker that was thinking of siting a factory in Alabama, and Alabama was all set. I mean, they'd given them millions of dollars in tax breaks and everything. They decided to put it in Toronto instead because they wouldn't have to pay health care costs.
Right, but it isn't even just that, because here's the thing, Tom. I've worked in healthcare. I'm a social worker in healthcare. And the truth is that once people become really ill, once they start to need healthcare, they often fall away from the very employment that provided their health insurance. And right. unless they have an extraordinary disability policy, they don't have the cash to pay their COBRA to keep their health insurance. And so at the point that they need the health insurance, they fall away from the system. And to carry that a little bit of a step further, that is that for most of us, our end-of-life care or the care we receive if we become chronically ill or disabled, both of those situations, which is the bulk, you know, a huge amount of health care, is delivered through what is a single-payer, taxpayer-supported system, which is Medicare and Medicaid. So what we have now is a system where the healthiest, most vibrant, most least in need of health care are the ones who are funding these dollars that are flowing ostensibly to health care, but in fact into a highly profitable industry. And at the point that they're no longer able to pay for that, quote, insurance because they're ill, they don't have any stockpile of resources sitting there.
Right. The bottom line, and I think this is apparent to everyone, Annie, the bottom line is our health care system in the United States benefits only those corporations that are in the health care business, period. And it certainly does not benefit the American people. We're paying twice as much, more than twice as much, than any other nation in the world on a per capita basis. And we have worse health care than most nations. So,
yeah.
In fact, we have worse health. We can't say we have worse health care than any nation, but there are several nations, many nations, some 30 nations, depending on the criteria that you use to define it, between 20 and 30 nations that have better health care than the United States, where it's not employer funded systems. So just to be very straightforward, am I summarizing your point?
Well, yes, and to make people really stop and think that what it, partly what this is a huge hijacking of healthcare dollars.
Yep.
And in fact, if I had been able to pay for the last 40 years my healthcare monies to a fund that was only dedicated to, you know, servicing healthcare and was never evaporated off into profit for an industry that was a pass-through for my money and who actually viewed having to meet their contract obligations with me as a loss. And, you know, so that...
Right. Got it. Are you suggesting that if you were able to do that and we were all doing that, that we would have basically that insurance company that we're talking about, what Social Security is for retirement and for people who become disabled, that Medicare could be, if we simply made Medicare universal, or are you pitching private health insurance accounts?
Well, I would, I am pitching a Medicare type system, and I think Dennis Kucinich really pointed out a lot of the details to that, which is that it isn't that we're suddenly going to be paying more, it's just that the money that is currently being paid into a sector that has outlived its usefulness in this healthcare debate, that money needs to be diverted into a fund, and once it is, then that there is the money to
yeah, more than enough money. Well said, Annie. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And absolutely well said. And it's an issue that we need to be bringing up. And I'm telling you, the next politician on a national or a local level, for that matter, who stands up and says, that's it, we're taking back our health care system, is going to do very, very well.
And I'm taking my country back.
Yeah, it's time for Taking My Country Back alert.
Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
No siree, Bob.
My job's been a oversee. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese.
Yes, indeed. The story of Michael Sessions.
And the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down and deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires. And you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my country.
There you go. Tony Stampley, the son of the legendary Joe Stampley, country music star, Taking My Country Back. Our theme music for our Taking My Country Back report. You can just call him Michael. They call him Your Honor now. This article by Carl Quintella in NBC News. English class wasn't the same on Wednesday. Yesterday, for Michael Sessions, his mom showed up for one thing, and reporters called asking the new mayor-elect of Hillsdale if they could talk with him. his honor. You can call him Michael. He's a high school senior who unofficially beat the incumbent Tuesday night with a write-in campaign he financed with his summer job earnings going door to door. Now, here's what motivated this kid. His father got laid off. His job was outsourced. Hillsdale, near Detroit, has lost a lot of jobs to outsourcing, including Michael's father's. Says Michael, your parent will come home and say you don't have a job, and you start thinking, and we have to cut back. Already, he says, he owes his victory to his base, his friends at the fire department who endorsed him. Hillsdale Deputy Fire Chief Ken Palkin, he says, I don't think his age is an issue. We're impressed with his enthusiasm.
Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you, and I don't lie.
So they've been looking at the old politicians and saying, we don't like what you're doing. We're gonna pick something new. This is a high school senior.
The Sony treats you like your royalty. You blew the budget and you botched. All right. Now I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed. So our Taking My Country Back alert, Michael Sessions, congratulations indeed. In fact, they say Michael Sessions is a rare example as cable TV generation for whom a political career does not seem a loser's bet. Who knows? Maybe he'll grow up to be president one day, says Hillsdale City Manager Tim Vagel. That question for now is off limits. Of course, Michael says, I'm taking it one step at a time, and I think you have to be 35 years old in order to be president of the United States. But in any case, it's a great excuse for us to play this marvelous music, Taking My Country Back from Honky Tonkers for Truth. Tony Stampley there, Taking My Country Back, indeed.
Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame. Tried to tell us it was all the same. But now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my time.
There we go. Come 2006, my friends. And it, day before yesterday, it started happening. Taking our country back. Thank you, Tony Stampley. News services refused to alter the transcript for the White House. That's pretty amazing. Almost beyond amazing. Here we have a White House press conference. David Gregory asked a question of, what's his name? Scotty McClellan, the White House press secretary. And in his question, there were a few predicating statements like, you know, Karl Rove was involved in this stuff, you know, this outing of Valerie Plame and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And Scotty, and in order to stop David Gregory basically from going into a rant, says, that's accurate. And at that point, David Gregory stops and gets right to his question. In other words, kind of get to the question. I'm not disagreeing with you. Just keep on going. And the White House then modifies the transcript that is published on the WhiteHouse.gov website to say that's not accurate. So here's the clip. And you can decide, right? We play,
whether
you
decide. Whether there's a question of legality,
here's
we
David
know
Gregory.
For a fact that there was involvement. We know that Karl Rove, based on what he and his lawyer have said, did have a conversation about somebody who Patrick Fitzgerald said was a covert officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. We know that Scooter Libby also had conversations.
That's accurate.
So aside from the question of legality here, you were wrong.
So now, just listen to this slowed down. Do you hear, Scotty? Because on the White House transcript, it says he said that's not accurate. Just listen here, slowed down.
The conversation.
That's accurate.
So aside from the question.
I think I heard a that's accurate there. It's pretty clear, but anyhow, the White House now, the Fox News Service, or I'm assuming FNS is Fox News Service, News Director Kirk Hahnemann, we took a look at it because they did not have a problem with it on that end. Anyway, we say it's correct. Their comment is a bit incongruous, says CQ's editor about the incident. A bit incongruous. It doesn't jive with what we have. Right. So the White House is still out there saying, no, Scotty was correcting David Gregory, when in fact it sounds to me, I suspect to you, like he was agreeing. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
Wouldn't that be nice? Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Thank you, Tom Rush. Tom Rush, back 30 years ago, nearly 30, 28 years ago, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire, and Tom Rush came out and did benefits for us. He also was living in New Hampshire at the time in Hillsboro, and I think he's out in Colorado now, but we kept in touch for a while. Good man, great music. Welcome back to our program. Republicans wincing from losses in two governor's races this week. This is the Wall Street Journal today. And President Bush's current political weakness face a broader problem as well, writes John Harwood on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Some of the party's most potent traditional advantages appear to be eroding. What might those traditional advantages be? Let's see. The traditional advantages of the Republican Party. Number one, they're in the pocket of big industry, so they have a lot of money to spend. Number two, they talk a good line. You know, the contract with America, Newt's contract with America. Let's have a balanced budget. Makes sense. I think, you know, most Americans, they understand that you have to, if you pay out more than you bring in, that you get in trouble. And you end up having to put it on your credit cards. And then the credit card companies basically own your butt. And you wouldn't want to do that if the credit card companies happen to be, say, the Communist People's Republic of China. So you would never want that to happen, right? And that's what the Republicans used to say. But they are not exactly masters of do what we do as well as what we say, instead of they're masters of do what we say rather than what we do. Republicans, John Harwood points out, Republicans currently hold a 231-203 edge over Democrats in the House with one seat vacant. In the Senate, their advantage is 55-45. Of 33 Senate seats up for grabs next year, 15 are held by Republicans. I mean, this is a conversation that 2 years ago nobody would even have thought about having. Is it possible that the Democrats could take both the House and the Senate 12 months from now? And I think it's possible. If enough of us get active, if enough of us get out there and get active, I think it's entirely possible. And then, of course, the next job is to wake up the Democratic Party, to kick out the DLC Democrats, or wake them up, enlighten them, say, hey, you know, you really don't need to suck up to corporations anymore for money. You really don't, because there are people out there who will give it to you on the Internet. It's easy now. There's this little, you know, you got PayPal and credit cards and just all this kind of cool stuff, secure socket logic technology. And you can just say, hey, you know, we're running a campaign and we'd like your help. By the way, just as a momentary digression, we'll be talking with Bernie Sanders on the program tomorrow, the first hour of the program. The head, John O'Neill, the head guy of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. Remember these guys? These guys who lied their way into devastating, destroying John Kerry's reputation in terms of his military service with lies and innuendo and distortions and half-truths. You know, we had one of the John O'Neill's partner, the guy who co-authored his book with him. We had him on this program a couple of times, and he'd try and spin this stuff. First time he thought he was on a conservative show. Oh, boy, that was fun. In any case, they have announced, day before yesterday, officially announced that the one thing they're going to try and do over the course of the next 12 months is take down Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the official, he's the official bullseye of the Swift Vote Veterans for Truth. They're reincorporating themselves under some other name, and they're going to put all of, and there's only 600,000 people in the state of Vermont. I mean, how much money can Bernie Sanders raise in Vermont? And his opponent is this rich Republican who has already committed $5 million of his own money to his own campaign. I used to go to Bernie's fundraisers where he'd show up, you know, and, you know, if you gave $5 or $10, it was a big deal. $25? Wow, that's a lot. And the admission was always free. Always free. And so now here we have this tragedy. So anyhow, the top prospects for Democratic gains in the Senate are in Pennsylvania, where Republican incumbent Rick Santorum trails his Democratic challenger. Tennessee, where Majority Leader Bill Frist is retiring. Ohio, where incumbent Mike DeWine is seeking a third term. And Rhode Island, where moderate incumbent Lincoln Chafee faces a conservative challenge in his party's primary. But I'm telling you, there's more than just those four. There's definitely more than just those four. The latest poll, this again from the Wall Street Journal, suggests Democrats have a greater opportunity for 2006 gains than either party imagined when Mr. Bush began his second term in January. So the tide is turning. And it's not about, hey, my side is winning, their side is losing, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't identify myself as a Democrat even. You know, I'm far more, you know, the Democratic Party is not progressive enough for me, frankly. But we have to, you know, we have to use the Democratic Party to take back this nation, just like the conservatives use the Republican Party to take back the nation and reform it in their dystopian ideal of a nation, you know, doing away with social safety nets, do away with Social Security. We need to take this country back and take it back to the ideals of Franklin Roosevelt, a true Democrat and a true progressive. We absolutely must. And we can if you all begin to participate. If you all begin to participate. And now, go to Democrats.org. Go to Democrats.com, by the way. You want to see some really progressive Democrats. And remember, democracy begins with you. Progressive begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Enjoy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.